In the main Talking About Organizations podcast, episode 41, I included a sidecast where I held aloft the image of Milton Hershey as a symbol of organizational commitment to its members. He was the face of a movement that ensured the well-being of the workers and their families and provided services, amusements, and just about anything a growing city could provide. And so he is lionized. I jumped on the bandwagon, you might say. But after consideration, since that episode was recorded, I've had some second thoughts. Perhaps his example should be scrutinized a little bit. My name is Tom Galvin, and these are my reflections on management. I want to take a moment and revisit the sidecast and talk about what it was in brief summary, and then talk about my ideas of what I was thinking about when I recorded it. The episode 41 was about Gareth Morgan's Images of Organization, and in the context of third part, which we look forward, think about possible research questions, areas to explore, final implications, the subject of commitment to members came up. And I was particularly inspired to go ahead and discuss organizational commitment to its members, because the inverse was generally what the literature had covered. You hear a lot about member commitment to the organization. What does it consist of? Such as how much we like being part of the organization, how much we owe the organization in terms of obligations or duties. There's a range of factors that spring up that are fairly common across the literature. But the inverse, the organizational commitment to its members, has not really been studied much, except to say that it's been looked at in terms of inducements, such as what an organization provides its members in order to encourage it to stay. And so I cover all of that in the sidecast. Milton Hershey, for his part, was the absolute exemplar. And the reason why I gravitated or was reminded of his story, of course, is because Hershey is only about a half an hour drive from Carlisle, where I presently live. And I am very familiar with the background of Milton Hershey and how much he had poured into the factory and how much he had created this city that bears his name, in which the people were provided for in many different ways. And included in that is during the times of the Great Depression, when competitive pressures and other reasons were causing massive layoffs and people going out of work, Milton Hershey took some extraordinary steps to try to ensure that his people were still employed. And he's not seen necessarily as an isolated example. His example pretty much colored a lot of the discussions about how organizations should take care of their members. Now, what I was thinking about at the time was the contrast with Uberization and algorithmic management and other organizational processes or behaviors in which the commitment of the organization to the individual was markedly different. Obviously, in those particular cases, there is not much expectation that the individuals are going to receive much from the organization except for financial incentives and pay and opportunity to work, say, at their own independent pace or at their own discretion to an extent, so long as they're willing to be available when the algorithms give them a task. But that contrast perhaps is a bit unfair, because Hershey, you know, even the company now, Hershey has since grown into a major international candy and confection company. And it, in a lot of ways, although it certainly continues to support its workers in ways that perhaps other companies do not, it has also become an international business and therefore has to respond to competitive pressures, which cause it to do things that perhaps Milton Hershey himself might not necessarily have approved. But the comparison with algorithmic management is perhaps not fair because it doesn't really provide a direct contrast, not nearly as much as, say, what we discussed in episode 49. And episode 49 was about tech culture. And this particular episode kind of shows sort of the dark side of organizational commitment to the individual, in which, indeed, it's largely based on inducements. And the inducements are not necessarily for the benefit of the individual, per se. That is, those inducements persist in order to essentially extract as much labor, as much service out of the individual as possible. I am talking about Gideon Kunda's great study of engineered culture and normative control in a tech firm in the 1980s. And this is where the organization, a tech startup that saw some rapid success and grew, but started to face some challenges. And it had developed a whole series of processes and expectations, if you will, that caused a significant number of people to work themselves to death. But to me, what was striking was how this normative control permeated the workers' personal lives, how it affected them at home, and how, for example, several cases of men and women who ended up with marital problems, depression, and all sorts of other problems that were indicators of burnout. In essence, the imposition of the work environment on the home life was very negative, certainly the opposite of Milton Hershey, and how the intent was to have that imposition be a positive or a rewarding inducement. I want to give another example, and this one I think is also kind of covers the other side of the Hershey story, in which, you know, Hershey, of course, provided the city, provided the living space. So the difference with Kunda's case, of course, is that living space was not provided by the firm. It was imposed upon. The home life was imposed upon, but it was not provided by the firm in the first place. When I was living in Europe, I found opportunities to go travel to some of the Eastern European countries, and this was at a time very close to when the wall had come down. And so I had the chance to travel in some places like Slovakia, Slovenia, Czech Republic, Poland, fairly fresh after as the East began to integrate a bit with the West. Of course, you know, different countries went through different processes in that regard. But there was one example that was just so striking. It came not very long after I had been stationed with the stabilization force in Bosnia. And so I did make an effort to go down to Slovenia, another part of the former Yugoslavia, which I had heard so much about and knew so little of. And so I visited the capital city of Ljubljana, which was gorgeous about 20 years ago when I went there, and I can only imagine how much nicer it has become now. But the example that I think of is and this isn't an isolated example. This was a very striking example of things that I saw a lot in Eastern European countries. And it was in the Slovenian-Austrian border town of Jesenice, which was a industrial city during the Cold War days. And at the time that I went, much of Jesenice had, at least the part that I saw, had not developed much since the end of the Cold War. It still seemed to be pretty much the way that it originally was. And that is to say, a lot of dull gray houses, uniform in perfect rows. I mean, the houses were just perfect carbon copies of each other, and that they were in varying states of disrepair. I mean, they were gray, they were concrete, they were largely untouched, and just everything about it, even though the surrounding area, the terrain was nice, you know, with green grass and all that, just the grayness of the town just was weighing down. And for me, it just proved to be an example, again, of what I saw in several other countries of how life was at the time, that indeed, this was a case where the community was provided, but it was not provided in the same way as Milton Hershey had provided for his people. What was provided was essentially a very drab appearing experience, in which the individual needs were not the primary consideration. But then one of the things that really struck me, why I remember Yesenitsa so much, was because when I did see these rows of gray houses, and they happened to be up on a hill, so I could see several, you know, how uniform the rows of houses were. And in the middle of all of these gray buildings was this one house in which the owner had apparently already undertaken an effort to renovate it. And instead of the same gray, this house had been repainted an absolute shocking purple. I wish so much I had the opportunity to get my camera and be able to take this shot, because it would have been an amazing shot. But it just sort of told you that, you know, kind of like, change was about to come to this part of the country, there were people who really were interested in breaking away from the grayness. And so even in the sidecast, when I talk about Milton Hershey, I sort of caveat it somewhat at the end, because I knew that in some instances, perhaps there are reasons why individual might not want the type of intrusion that a Hershey might provide, because who's to say that the tide doesn't turn, that competitive pressures or other things start to turn these positive inducements into something that is more controlling, so more intrusive. And what was once, you know, perhaps a living paradise becomes a living hell. So as I started to think about that, okay, it's very easy to think about, you know, Hershey as the example. But I think in truth, we do have to be very pragmatic about how do we consider, you know, the level of commitments to be about just right. And I think the way to think about it is that individuals, and I'm hearkening back to the main podcast, episode 3, when we talk about Maslow and individual needs. I think in a lot of ways, you know, there are some common sense of what individuals want or what individuals need to be able to participate in society. And then the question becomes, who is it best to provide those needs? Is it the individual, him or herself? Is it the organizations to which the individual belongs, or is it the government or the society to which the individual belongs? And that is, if the organizations, which might be workplace, it could also be other types of organizations, if those are different from the community or society. So what we can think about is how, as those needs become costly, the question comes, well, if the organization can no longer afford to provide those inducements or satisfy those needs, then does it become necessarily a transfer or a burden on the society? Or does it become a burden on the individual, the expectation of the individual to fend for him or herself? Conversely, also, the individuals may want to have those needs met by themselves and not rely on organizations or society if they feel that the satisfaction of those needs is not to their personal benefit or in their best interest. So we could certainly see how the conversation, say at a political level, is constantly a different tensions of, on the one side, we are trying to figure out what is the best way to satisfy the needs, and on the other hand, who is best to satisfy it. And there's not really a single clean answer, is there? So I think the thing that we have to take away from all of this is that organizational commitment to the members and member commitment to the organization, I try not to think about those as good or bad, but perhaps value neutral. What are the needs that are being satisfied? What are the needs and who's satisfying them? And is it aligned with the interests of both parties, the organization and the individual? And if it's not aligned, then how is it best to get it aligned? And so if we do come to grips with the concept and the meaning of alignment in this regard, then perhaps we may finally be able to understand better to what extent did Milton Hershey have it right, and to what extent do other models of organizational commitment to the membership make more sense and provide better benefit. And that's all for now. The views expressed are my own and do not necessarily reflect those of the United States Army War College, the United States Army, or the Department of Defense. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.